Hello, my name's Andrew Garthwaite, Chief Equity Strategist. I'm here with Elroy Dimpson, Professor of Finance and key contributor to the Global Investment Returns Yearbook. In this episode, we're going to be taking a high-level look at our recently published yearbook and exploring some of the themes. Thank you very much, Elroy, for joining us. With 126 years of data to reference, could you provide a historical perspective of why you started up the yearbook and in particular why you feel people should be using it?
Well, the yearbook started with an exercise at the beginning of this century. We thought that as we entered the 21st century, it would be nice to look back to the past. And at that time, the only thing that we had was histories for the US and a little bit for the UK. And yet increasingly, we were talking to an international audience. And so we moved towards assembling evidence for a number of countries. They appeared in a Princeton University press book published in the very early years of this century called Triumph of the Optimists, the optimists being the people who invested in common stocks rather than government bonds. Once we did that, we discovered that there were lots of questions that we could answer by looking at history. And so we produced a yearbook and another and another and another. And the yearbook is substantial. Somebody was complaining to me that the latest edition of the yearbook weighs nearly a kilo. And that's a lot of book. But there's always something new to share. And we've continued with that exercise now for over a quarter of a century.
Thank you. Looking at the US today, you highlight it's roughly 62% of global market cap. Could you put that into some historical perspective? How often can it stay at this level or indeed even get to higher levels?
Well, when our database begins, which is 1900, the US was sizable, but it was certainly not the largest stock market by market cap in the world. And it's grown over the years, sometimes with setbacks. There was a brief period when it was the second biggest and not the biggest stock market in the world. It was overtaken by Japan, but Japan's superiority didn't last for very long. So we've had the US growing from about 15% to over 60% of the world's market cap. How does it get to be larger? There's two sources of that. One is stock market performance, and the other one is issuance of shares, IPOs and seasoned equity offerings. So when you ask me how long it can stay at 62%, valuations can go up or down, and initial offerings can be substantial. So there's no reason at all why the US shouldn't increase, and it has in the past been a little bit larger than its current weighting in the world.
Looking at your yearbook, you have emerging markets slightly outperforming developed markets since 1960. What regions do you think give the most attractive long-term performance given historical returns?
Okay, let's look at this in terms of long-term history. Long-term history is one in which emerging markets sit behind overall over the last 126 years. But in the later period, which you're referring to, they've performed a little bit better. So the earlier period had all the ravages of war, and later periods they have at times done better. The big performance in world stock markets has come about from the largest companies, which have persistently done well. Of the 10 largest companies, nine are American and one is from Taiwan. So what would lead to greater performance? It's some breakthroughs from important companies in emerging markets.
If I may, going on to a more pertinent near-term issue around new technologies, what does history tell you about whether or not we get a bubble and the long-term merits of investing even when you think you may be close to the peak of that bubble?
Well, it's an even when you think. The problem is we don't know. I don't know when we're hitting a peak for a bubble until the bubble is in the past. So when a particular sector gets to be expensive, we don't know whether that's going to continue trending in the right direction or whether there's going to be a burst. For you and me, our memories extend back to the TMT bubble. The TMT bubble was a bubble which collapsed, and then technology reasserted itself. So the long-term performance of technology has been superior to that of the market as a whole, even though we had a dot-com bust, which looked absolutely awful at the time. So history is full of examples like that, of cases where you've got sectors that might do badly. Might do badly like, for example, US railroads when trucking became an investable sector, or railroads when air transport became an investable sector. In the end, railroads did better than any of the other alternatives that I've mentioned, better than the market, better than trucking, better than air transport. So sometimes there's a case where you spotted a bubble and yet still it's better to stick with the with stocks which look as though they're getting left behind. And other times it's good to stick with stocks that are going up that may maintain their momentum. We've just been through several years, I'm thinking now up to 2025, in which stocks that were big did well and continue to do well. And anybody who got nervous about whether they were in a bubble 8, 6, 5, 4 years ago made a big mistake pulling out of the technology stocks which were driving the market.
Yes, I think you mentioned very interestingly that even since 1900, when the railway companies were 63% of the US market, they actually have outperformed the newer technologies or the stock market since that date. And again, if you invested in tech at the peak in March 2000, you've actually outperformed the index by 4% since a year since then. Perhaps the lesson is, if the theme is right, don't worry so much about the valuation. You'll grow into the valuation. Going on to something similar, when you highlight that just 4.5% of stocks have outperformed bonds in the last 100 years, do you want to just sort of highlight a bit more about market concentration and the degree to which, to which companies change and how the market today looks dramatically different from that of 10, 50 or 100 years ago?
Well, I think that the starting point on this is the nature of limited liability. We're trading in shares which can lose you only 100% of your investment. So on the upside, you can make 100%, 200%, 500%. If you make the right choices. So it's scarcely surprising that since individual stocks can do exceptionally well, scarcely surprising that the typical stock does not do well, because the typical stock will either go up or go down, but never go down by worse than 100%. So this is a finding which comes from the research of a number of others. This is reported by us, but draws on other studies. And it's unusually been adopted by both passive and active managers to explain why what they do is the right thing. So active managers point to the fact that since more than half of all stocks lose you money, almost three quarters of them fail to beat the index, you need to choose the right stocks. And then you've got passive managers who point out that if you select stocks, they will typically lose money because there will be a small number of big winners and you'll fail to capture those big winners unless you diversify broadly. So you've got the same set of data being used by both protagonists for active management and protagonists for passive management. I think the key is that if you are confident that you've got a capacity to identify outperforming stocks, then that's a skill which is rare and which should be utilized. If you don't believe you can select the right stocks or the right sectors, then you should be highly diversified.
I would echo that because I've seen your research cited on both sides, both active and passive. Very interesting. You highlight the benefits of diversification, but you also highlight that since 2021, bonds have not diversified. How often does this happen historically? And do you have any views on the diversification merits of bonds going forward?
Well, let me tell you what we used to teach in the 20th century. We used to teach that bonds, obviously, the present value of a stream of cash flows, and the way we present value it is to use the yield, but that equities must to some extent have similar attributes. So if the required rate of return changes, we ought to see the equity market moving in sympathy. So what we used to teach was that if interest rates went down, then equities should also do well. But in the early 21st century, that's not how markets behaved. There were other factors which were important. I think that looking to the future, the guidance that we used to give in the last century is probably right for the second and third quarters of the 21st century. That is that interest rates have a bearing on both groups, but the extent to which you can diversify by spreading money between equities and bonds is somewhat more limited than the period in which they moved in opposing directions.
So you're sort of saying the 60-40 model is a little bit dangerous now?
Yeah, I mean, people still talk about 60-40, occasionally 70-30. When we look back in time, that was a pretty good approach. But I think you should bear in mind that markets evolve over time. If you are looking at the performance of 60-40 from 1900 onwards, in 1900 it would have been very strange to have a 60-40 split because bonds were fearfully important and equities were less important. Equities grew in value and have become more important. Looking to the future, there may be similar sorts of rules of thumb which work for limited periods, but about which you should be cautious. I guess I'm in favor of avoiding churn in a portfolio. So having broad diversification and sticking with it over a long period makes sense. Whether the 60-40 kind of rule, that is one which involves fairly frequent annual, sometimes even quarterly rebalancing back to those 60-40 proportions, I think modest rebalancing makes sense.
Moving on from diversification of bonds and equities towards gold and inflation, how do you think we should be looking at gold at the moment as an inflation hedge?
Gold is not an interest-bearing or dividend-yielding asset. So for institution, it has a limited role. It has at times moved in the opposite direction to inflation. It's provided some benefits, but those are very unreliable.
I was fascinated also to see that index-linked bonds have actually underperformed equities in periods of an inflation shock, which is contrary to what perhaps some people would believe. And I thought that's very interesting research.
Well, the obvious riposte to that is that inflation-linked bonds give you a long-term real return that you understand. And what we're looking at is the year-to-year performance of bonds which have a long life. So held to maturity, we know that the real return is going to be what you expected it to be. But year to year, it has a different role.
And finally, to finish where we started, what do you think should be the overarching message about how investors should look at this yearbook?
Well, I think one key message is diversification, global diversification, not simply diversification within individual markets, across asset diversification. And of course, control of costs. So the paper performance that you record for a particular strategy, you hope, will be replicated in practice for the portfolio. And that means modest turnover and sticking to a strategy rather than high turnover and market timing.
Thank you very much for visiting the UBS Research Pod Hub. This was an overview of our Global Investment Returns Yearbook with myself, Andrew Garthwaite, and Elroy Dimpson. Please do take a careful look at the charts, particularly figure 3. I think that will put a lot of your returns into perspective.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries and or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation, nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax, and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content and has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory, or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction, where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept liability over any such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. Copyright UBS 2026. The key symbol and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.